Blog Talk Radio.
Now we can see a new world coming into view. A world in which there is a very real prospect of a new world order.
The new world order does not mean surrendering our national sovereignty or forfeiting our interests.
Bullshit.
He took an oath to defend the Constitution of the United States of America. By some, he's been called controversial.
How can I convince you when your ears refuse to hear?
Now, keep in mind that some of my guests have been approached by Homeland Security or FBI saying, why are you going on the Clay Douglas Show?
My message to those guys, if they're listening this morning, is good morning. Go get a cup of coffee. Maybe you'll learn something.
Yeah, sit down. I've always invited you. I hope you come into my lecture, man. You know, we both took the same oath to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. I don't recall there being an expiration date on that.
He is the free American, Clay Douglas.
How can I contain this anguish and this pain?
Catch the Free American weekday mornings at 10 a.m. Eastern, 7 a.m. Pacific. For the podcast and more details, go to freeamerican.com.
Every time I think about the damage that's been done.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another edition of the Free American. I'm your host. I am Clay Douglas. And a few things I want to discuss with you today. Not sure quite what to read into it. And as far as the chat room, yeah, I remember this is Red. I remember you. Under that name, I don't know whose side you are because you're one of those waffling motherfuckers that doesn't know whether you're my friend or my foe. Don't know what the fuck you're doing, so I don't know whether to kick you or welcome you. So fuck you. I'll just see what kind of person you are, what kind of guest you are in my chat room, so I can make up my mind whether I want to kick your ass or let you just sit there and listen. If I were you, I'd just sit there and shut up and not say a fucking word in my chat room, and maybe I'll let you stay. And you people that are trying to call in on blog numbers, fuck you. I'm not putting you. And Barry, you fag, fat, motherfucker, transvestite, get out of my room. Don't ever fucking come back. And the rest of you pros that are calling in, fuck you. I'm not even taking any more goddamn calls. And I'm just thinking about you dumb motherfuckers out there. I'm moved. Here, I get these restricted numbers that call in, and suddenly my phone's disconnected. Yeah, I know when I'm fucking disconnected, you dumb motherfuckers in the chat room. If I were you, if you want to tell me something obvious there, I'd keep my mouth shut or I'll fucking kick your ass out. You hear me there, Johnny Longfeather, whoever the fuck you are. And these shows are junk. You think so? You ignorant son of a bitch. Here's my boot up out of your ass, you son of a bitch. They're disconnecting me on the phone lines here. So if you don't hear me for a moment, I'll be back. I just feel moved to communicate with you musically. If you don't like my music, you be sure and let me know. If you don't like my singing, you be sure and let me know, and I'll put a boot so far up your ass, you may never fucking get it back out. A hunk of a man with a beer in his hand. He looked like a drunk old fool. And I knew if I hit him right, why I could knock him right off of that stool. But everybody, they said, watch out. Hey, that's Tiger Man McCool. He's had a whole lot of fights, and he's always come out a winner. Yeah, he's a winner. But I had myself about five too many, and I walked up tall and proud. I faced his back, and I faced the fact that he had never stooped or bowed. I said, Tiger Man, you're a pussycat. And a hush fell on the crowd. I said, let's you and me go outside and see who's the winner. Well, he gripped the bar with one big hairy hand and he braced against the wall. He slowly looked up from his beer. My God, that man was tall. He said, boy, I see you're a scrapper. So just before you fall, I'm going to tell you just a little what it means to be a winner. He said, now you see these bright white smiling teeth, you know they ain't my own. Mine rolled away like chiclets down the street in San Antone. But I left that person cursing, nursing seven broken bones. And he only broke three of mine. That makes me the winner. And behind this grin, I got a steel pin that holds my jaw in place. Well, even Blog Talk don't seem to like my singing. They cut me out. I see. American Writer, you're telling me to calm down? Fuck you, they just got you kicked out, you ignorant son of a bitch. Goodbye. Yeah, Joe Crossley, I know my goddamn phone dropped off. I can see that the goddamn phone dropped off. I'll tell you what, I'm just going to kick everybody out of this fucking chat room. Let me just look for a moment here. John Glubby. Again, you're telling me the obvious, John? Grand Rabbi Ted, rabbis aren't allowed in my chat room, you son of a bitch. All right, you just fuckers just hang out just a minute. Where's John Crossley? Do something about it. Complain to YouTube, you ignorant son of a bitch. Quit interrupting my show to tell me that or I'll block your ass. John Glubney, get up. You people, I don't want you in my room ever again, you ignorant motherfucker. You people want to come in my room and insult me? I'll kick your ass right out. Crossley, do what I told you. Complain to fucking call on my behalf. Go to YouTube, and get this motherfucker taken off. Take these fucking pictures off. Gluttony don't come back. No, Rob from Omaha, you're barred from my show forever, you ignorant motherfucker. Get out. Goodbye. Don't come back. Rob from Omaha, fuck you. I get it. Yeah. You're sorry for upsetting me. Fuck you. You're out of here. And Phoenix Speaks, if I call your number again today and you don't answer, I'll never let you back in the room again. You understand that? You better send me the... All right. Somehow my phone keeps getting disconnected. Nothing wrong with my phone. So somebody's fucking with it. And kicking these motherfuckers out as fast as I can. All right, let's do this. Roy Moore talking here about George Soros, who's financing Antifa, who's already got their T-shirts into Walmart here. Roy Moore tells Soros he's going to hell. All right. Blog Talk keeps dropping off. Blog Talk keeps dropping our sound here. I get back to the back on as quickly as possible. And let me do this real quick here. Hello, you dumb son of a bitch. You want to talk to me, you ignorant motherfucker? You want to call me names? You ignorant motherfucker, you holding stolen property. You're holding stolen property. The police know it's stolen property. They've got the Mexican consulate wants to get you for fucking theft, for kicking in that door and stealing from that poor Mexican. So what do you want? I'll have an officer... Richard Dalton, case number 7764J9, calling you from El Paso. You fucking Randy Anderson, you lie. All right. I don't know what's going on here, man. My phone keeps dropping every 5 fucking minutes here. Somebody doesn't want the information we're getting out today. Barry, what the fuck do you want? What do you want coming back on my goddamn show and back into my chat room? Can't you understand I don't want you in here? Can't you understand that?
What the blue hell's going on with you today? Why do you keep cutting out? This is really pissing me off, sir.
Pissing me off. It's my goddamn phone that keeps hanging up here when I call Blog Talk. Fuck you, Barry. Don't even fucking talk to me again. Don't come back on my show. Don't come back on my show. And And who's this? Okay, this son of a bitch. Randy Anderson. You got stolen property there. The Mexican government wants it back. They want your ass.
That's not true because I... first of all, I've already asked you. We've been messaging back and forth this morning, and you said you didn't even want the damn books. Now you want them back? I mean, get the shit out of your fucking mouth and explain yourself. Well, it sounds like...
All right. I don't know what to tell you here, folks. I don't know what to tell you because every time I get connected here, doesn't matter what phone I use, Blog Talk disconnects me. No, I'm just kicking these stupid motherfuckers out as fast as I can. And let me address this again. We'll try this again. Randy Anderson.
Yeah.
Have I got you now?
Yeah, you have my you got me. As long as you stop hanging up on me, goddammit. I mean, that's not very mature.
You ignorant motherfucker. I'm the one that's being hung up on by Blog Talk Radio, and you better quit addressing me like that, or I'll come down there, Brownsville, kick your fucking ass. Now listen to me, you son of a bitch. Those books you got are stolen from this person in Juarez, and the Mexican cop wants to know who did it, wants to know where those books are.
Well,
the El Paso
just say this.
Police have called. Shut up! Shut up, you motherfucker! I'll hang up on you.
What I'm trying to tell you, okay? Huh? Okay, go ahead. I'm trying to explain what the situation, what transpired yesterday. We did have the police come over, and the only thing they confiscated was the goddamn van. So I have stupid ass books in my barn, and you haven't said what you wanted me to do with them. Can anyone hear me? Oh, God, do I have carte blanche on the line?
All right. I'm back here.
Okay.
For a moment here, every time I
get on
there.
Stop hanging up on me, damn it.
You're a motherfucker. Hey, fuck you. Fuck you. You can talk to the cops. You don't talk to me no more.
Do you want them or not?
I'm not hanging up on
nobody. Do you want the goddamn books? Jesus Christ.
They're hanging up on me, you ignorant son of a bitch. Go to hell. Go to hell. Don't get them out of my show no more. I don't know who's doing this, fucking. No, fuck Andrew. Fuck Randy Anderson. He can talk to the cops. I ain't talking to him no more. He's holding stolen property that were stolen from this other asshole in Mexico who turned me into the consulate. The consulate called the San Francisco or the San Antonio police. And now... they're trying to link me to this. I'll be calling El Paso police and giving them that shit. And the ignorant people in, here stole printed books, knocked off my books, sent them to Brian Zamora in Juarez. And then evidently this motherfucker Randy Anderson stole them and then called me and tells me he has them and trying to get money out of me for them. So fuck all of them. And Mary, fuck you. Go get your sex change operation and stay off my goddamn show. You understand that, you goddamn queer motherfucker?
I have information on your book, sir. But you keep hanging up on me.
Shut up. Don't fucking say anything to me other than give me the information, you ignorant fucking queer.
Is that necessary to call me that, sir? Listen, Randy Anderson has your books.
Yeah,
okay?
That's what he says.
He has all of your books, and he has them in his garage. Okay? The van has been confiscated. He needs to know what to do with the books. The books are in his garage. He's got a ton of them. It's like $90,000 worth of books.
Bullshit.
So, I'm not kidding you.
They're stolen. They're stolen, and they're counterfeit anyway. They're broken. Somebody fucking printed them right here in fucking Big Spring.
But he wants to know. But you keep hanging up on us. We're trying to help you get your books back.
Listen, you ignorant motherfucker. I keep getting disconnected by Blog Talk Radio. I'm not hanging up on nobody. They're hanging up on me, you ignorant son of a bitch.
Well, you hung up on me. You called me a fat Jew.
Fat fag. You're a fat fucking Jewish fag. So what? Nobody's hanging. I'm not hanging up on nobody. You quit pointing the fucking finger at me and just tell me what information you've got. So I've got.
He has all the books in his garage. He wants to give them back to you.
Bullshit.
Because
he wants me to pay for stolen merchandise. I'm not doing that.
Well, how much does he want you to pay?
I don't know. I don't give a fuck. I'm not buying stolen merchandise from somebody that stole it. He stole it. I'll send the El Paso police down to arrest the motherfucker. Fuck you.
Is he blackmailing?
Fuck him.
Is he blackmailing you? Is he blackmailing you? Is that what he's doing to you?
Trying to.
All right, I'll see if I can get involved and try to get him back for you, sir. I'm doing this because even though you called me so many names in the past, I can't even remember half of them. I'm going to do
you
this out of the
goodness of my heart. You've been involved with Steve, trying to hijack me, trying to take my website, using my goddamn name. You can go to hell. Fuck you. Goddamn you, you son of a low-life son of a bitch. You haven't done anything to help me. Never done anything but try to hurt me. You're a low-life son of a bitch, and go to hell.
Sir, that's so wrong. You got me completely wrong. I'm your...
Bullshit. You're a lying cocksucker. It is D-E-R, you ignorant son of a bitch. Now get out of my goddamn chat room, you ignorant son of a bitch. It's a breed of Chihuahua. It's called a deer Chihuahua, you dumb son. Another dumb son of a bitch. Oh, my God. Oh, I hope that's true. Michael Fratto, so that's who the son of a bitch is. No, I don't think so. I don't think I'll do that. Thanks. Here's a Channel 9 of Crime Watch. Midland resident Michael Fratto is allegedly connected to an international counterfeiting book smuggling operation based out of a local business in Big Springs. Good work, guys. Somebody's finally done something fucking right. All right. All right. All right, let's see what else we got here. Since the fucking phones keep dying, I almost hesitate to do anything else here. Yeah, we're going to kick all these fucking fake guests out. And, you're right. What are you coming back for, you druggy, ignorant motherfucker? What do you want,
well,
Randy?
First of all, okay, well, first of all, the reason I call back is because you keep hanging up on me. That's the first thing. Second
okay,
of all,
so
I want to deal with...
Here,
I want,
you son of a bitch.
I want
to,
what I
want
to do is
yet,
talk
to
you about
the...
Okay, go... Okay, I
now,
just want to resolve
this. Printed those books, the guy that printed those books that are in jail is in jail
yeah.
here. The story just appeared in fucking Midland News. We got his name. He printed those books. Your head and then so you went in and stole them from the guy in Mexico.
Jesus.
Evidently. So
no,
you're going to be charged
with
that.
That's not true. They broke my fence. Clay, they broke onto my property. They left
I
the van.
I think you're a lying motherfucker. I think you're a lying
well,
motherfucker.
Well, then how come the police
the
didn't do anything?
Me, you son of a bitch.
How come the police didn't do anything?
Me,
they
you
came
you
and...
Lost any respect. You're a fucking thief. You're a
you
fucking
keep your
thief.
Mouth shut
you
when
got,
I'm talking and stop hanging up on me. That's not true. That's not true
you're
at all. They broke into my property. They broke into my
property.
All you want to do is talk over people, don't you? That's what you do. You talk over people. I just want to get a word in. Can I do that?
Fuck you. Go ahead.
They're the ones who broke into the property. I have the books. Yes, I have 18 boxes. Barry, I spoke to Barry. A gentleman got a hold of me because I don't know how the – if you gave my phone number, I mean, I think that's – that's wrong. I mean,
your
you shouldn't be giving out my phone number.
Hold it. You dumb son of a bitch. When you call in, everybody in fucking Blog Talk can see your fucking number, you ignorant son of a bitch.
Well, okay. Well, I didn't know that. I'm not familiar with it. But anyway, so I did speak to Barry.
That's
Barry,
you're a dumb son of a bitch.
I told him what happened. The cops took the van. I ended up keeping the books. They didn't want the books. They don't give a shit about Mexican law. So I do have the books. It's 18 of them, 18 boxes. And then, well, to be quite honest, you know, when I started talking to the gentleman, to Barry, and I started telling him about, you know, how profitable it is, it kind of seems to me as if he's even interested in possibly getting a couple of the books because he can, you know, sell them at his store. I mean, imagine that.
Sure,
I mean, this could
they're
big.
All cons. You're all fucking thieves. You're all fucking con men.
You know
you're
my address. I'm not hiding behind anything. I'm not hiding behind anything. Just stop
Shut
hanging
up.
Up on me and we'll be fine.
Shut
the only
up.
Thing I want to do is... What? God,
you
know my address.
Are trying to
you know my phone number.
My work. I wrote those books and this motherfucking Michael Fratto fucking counterfeited them and printed them and...
I don't know
stole
that guy. How crazy are you? You think I know that guy all of a sudden? Someone
no,
breaks
I'm
into
just
my
telling
property.
You, I just found out, you goddamn son of a bitch. I just told you what his fucking name was from the Midland paper. Now listen to me. You
well, it sounds like you're trying to assume
trying to
that
fucking,
I'm part of...
You're the one trying to talk over me. You're trying to make excuses.
Go ahead. Go ahead. You're right.
And you're trying to profit. You're trying to fucking blackmail me. And I'm gonna file charges on you today.
So what would you want me to do?
Police.
You want me to drive
every,
all the way up there and
saying,
deliver books to you?
Shut up! Everything you're saying right now is being recorded, you ignorant son of a bitch. And I'm turning it into the Big Spring Police Department, and I'm charging you with blackmail.
And what am I going to do
goods.
With it? You can bring your ass down and pick them up. I'm not, what do you want me to do, drive them up there and drop them off in front of your fucking trailer? I'm not
yeah.
doing that crap. No, hell no. You can
yeah.
come pick them up if you want, and you watch your mouth when you're in front of my wife. If you do come down, I'll slap the
fuck
shit
you.
Out of you.
Yeah, I'd love for you to try that, you motherfucker. You'd end up in a fucking hospital, you ignorant son of a bitch.
You're an old man now. Come on, stop it. Stop.
Yeah.
You're old.
Yeah, I'm an old man, and I can kick
you. Do you want the goddamn books or not, huh? You're slipping deeply into salinity, okay? I don't want you yelling or causing any problems. You've already given out my phone number to Barry. And I don't know. Do you want me to get – well, Barry offered to pick up the books. I don't know if you want me to give them to him. It's totally up to you.
I don't want you to give them to another fucking con man, especially a queer fucking Jew con man.
I'm a goddamn farmer. I don't know what the hell you're even talking about. They broke into my property. They leave a fucking shitty-ass van. The cops came. I asked them, do they need the books or can they stay here? They said, just leave them there. The only thing they worried about was the van because the van was stolen. So now what do you want me to do about it? I mean, and now you won't tell me, oh, you're saying I'm stealing them. No, you haven't offered to come down here and pick them up, have you? Oh, God, did you hang up? You hung up on me again, you son of a bitch?
No.
Why do you keep hanging up? I see. Now you're giving me the old silent treatment, huh? Well, it's not going to work, Clay. You can't just stay silent on the phone like this. Say something. Ah, the old silent treatment. This is very immature, Clay, that you just – all you're doing is giving me the silent treatment. I mean, maybe you should say something. Be a man.
Okay,
step up
now,
to the
wait
plate.
A minute. Hold on, you son of a bitch. We got disconnected again. Broadcast got disconnected. I had to call back in, and I've done that.
Oh, I thought you were giving me the old silent treatment.
Oh, God damn it. I don't know what's wrong with Blog Talk. I've used two different phones, and I've called in about a half a dozen times and been disconnected.
Yeah. Well, look, Clay, let's just resolve this. I'm you know, I don't want to get upset with you, and I hope you can stop getting upset with me. These are the facts. I have the books. What do we do from here? Hello, Clay? Clay, I don't know if this is even true about the goddamn it sounds like you're just doing the old silent treatment on me. Every time I bring something up, now you're just trying to make it – you're just clamming up on me. Give me an answer, yes or no. Do I keep the books? Do I not keep the books? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm calling back into a live show again. Every time you start to say something, they disconnect us. Here, and I have to call back in, so let's start this all over again now.
Okay, we'll do it quick before you hang up.
I want to see them. They're evidence. They are stolen from Mexico. They were printed by this fucking crook that's already been arrested for counterfeiting my books.
Okay.
And I need them for
so
the
what do
evidence. I need to get them to the police. I need them to get them to the police department. I've got three different, one of probably a fake police. But I know who. I got a case
That's not
number
true.
Here. What?
First of all, the Brownsville Police Department did come out. Well, actually, Sheriff's
Good.
Department.
I called
and they
them.
Took the van.
Yeah.
That's all they wanted.
Okay.
They didn't care
That's
about
fine.
The books.
Shut up. You ignorant son of a
so
bitch.
So what the
I'm
hell am I
Julian.
Supposed to do?
I,
you know,
God
you're trying to talk
you.
Over me again.
Hey, shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up. I've got a case number here with the Big Spring Police Department about this.
You know what? You make me feel very uncomfortable every time you yell at me. You act like I'm a kid, and I have these goddamn books. I'm over it. I'm done. Don't call me.
All right. We're going to keep on trying here. Now, do you think that you can just... Where are you still here? Where did we lose this son of a bitch? Hey, where are we at here? I guess I lost the son of a bitch. I am not paying ransom on stolen property. I wrote the books. They belong to me, whether they're counterfeited or not. It's stolen property. I will let the police sort that out. And whoever this ignorant motherfucker is, I'll let the Big Spring police sort it out. This Randy Anderson. I guess he decided to give it up and hang it up. He thinks I'm hanging up on him. I'm not. No, you're not in the host queue anymore, you son of a bitch. All right. He's logged out. Jesus Christ. You know, I'm tired of my calls dropping too. God damn. Omaha Rob, get out of my room, don't ever fucking come back. Sick of you. What else we got? All right. Let's see what's going on here. That might be. That may be, Darth. I don't care. I'm tired of it anyway. Fuck 'em. Let's see if we can do this.
Started calling the first Illuminati bankers and industrialists robber barons. Of course, once these fortunes began, others naturally trying to get in on the act. One who succeeded was J.P. Morgan, who became a private banker during this period. But modern critics have discovered that far from being the richest man in America everyone thought he was, it turned out upon his death that Morgan actually only owned 17% of Morgan Bank, and that like so many others, he was simply a front for the Rothschilds family. 5 years after E.H. Harriman died and handed on the business to his sons, W. Averill Harriman and E. Roland Harriman, this new breed of Western business moguls faced their first really big test with the coming of World War I. Once again, we've
been... All right, again, I don't, not me yelling this time. It's just disconnecting. Somebody is breaking into the line here. And I'm being disconnected. I hear a little tone, and I'm disconnected. We'll see if we can play this a little bit more.
Many observers at the time had their doubts as to whether Western industrial capitalism, which was still in its infancy, could cope with the demands of war production. In the world economic recession which followed, many feared these fledgling industries might vanish altogether as countries struggled with debt and war reparations. But actually, Western capitalism emerged from World War I in a far stronger state than it was in at the beginning. So how could this be? The First World War was the new class of international...
All right, try it again here.
Take, for instance, Remington. We tend to associate their name with typewriters, but actually, they made most of the rifles and handguns used during the Great War and made a colossal fortune in the process. The banks, in their turn, lapped this up because it meant that defense contractors were having no trouble repaying the huge loans they had outstanding and, best of all, the world's richest nations have had to borrow huge sums from the merchant bankers in the first place to finance the war, the Americans and the British just as much as the Germans. And they would now be repaying these loans to the banks for decades to come at a steep rate of interest. For international merchant bankers, the Rothschilds in particular, the First World War had been a gift from heaven. And people watching this should ask themselves a simple question before passing judgment. Supposing you were in business during and the contract.
Well, we're trying again every time, 2 minutes into it, and it disconnects.
Or gunpowder was netting you millions every year in profit. And then one day the war ended, and your money stopped completely. What do you think your attitude to war might be? That war was good for business was not the only lesson the ruling class has learned during this period. The Russian Revolution of 1917 terrified rich people all over the world. Watching Lenin and Trotsky taking over such a vast area of the globe, the kings and queens of Europe's tiny sovereign states in particular became extremely nervous.
All right, what's happening here is every time I start doing the show that I get a call from a block number or an anonymous number, and the case, the line goes dead, and I have to redial. So it's something's happening here. I have nothing to do with that, and there's no way I can stop it. The phone rings. That's right. My books are at shop.freeamerican.com. None of your business what phone company I use.
Supposing the communist success in Russia should inspire their own working class to rise in revolt. Many of the crown heads of Europe, like England's George V, had been related to Tsar Nicholas, and the brutal execution of the Tsar and his family, particularly the bayoneting of his young daughters, sent a shockwave through the upper classes of every nation. Did a similar fate lie in store for the royal families of Holland, Sweden, Spain, and England? This question was lying heavily on the thoughts of the elite when the First World War ended in 1918, and it had the effect of focusing the minds of the new Illuminati bankers and industrialists on the question of what to do for best for the defeated and dilapidated Germany. The population were poor, penniless, and worn out, yet the German economy still contained some of the most sophisticated and expensive industrial stock on the planet. The Illuminati sensed an opportunity. Supposing, as the world's first international businessmen, they could get their hands on Germany's steel mills, her coal mines, her factories, ports, and her shipbuilding industry. Over the years, certain names have become very familiar to those who maintain an interest in the Kennedy assassination. None more so than Alan Dulles, whom Kennedy fired after the Bay of Pigs disaster, and yet later he somehow managed to chair the Warren Commission, which was supposed to be investigating Kennedy's death. Know, however, is that Dulles and his older brother John Foster Dulles wrote the Treaty of Versailles. They were both lawyers, Sullivan and Cromwell, and it was largely they who decided that the German people must pay war reparations totaling 135 billion marks. A mind-boggling sum at that time, which today translates into 250 trillion. When this was announced, the legendary UK economist J. Maynard Keynes maintained it was a ludicrous sum, and he did a swift calculation from which he reasoned that it would take Germany until 1988, 60 years hard labour, to pay it off. But it didn't. So why? Maynard Keynes sensed that the Dulles brothers, backed as they were by the new Illuminati, were trying quite deliberately to sabotage the German economy. And they succeeded. A As mass unemployment led to hyperinflation, the famous stories of people papering their walls with worthless Reichsmarks and handing over their life savings for a loaf of bread soon followed. With German investors on their knees, the new Illuminati moved in and began buying up shares of stock in German industry at a knockdown price. Now, why did they do this? The cynical mind would say to make a buck, but it really wasn't that simple. What they wanted was to make Germany strong again so that she would become a bulwark against Soviet communism.
Germany was fighting for its life. Certain measures were needed to protect it from its enemy. I cannot say that I am sorry we applied those measures. We were a bulwark against Bolshevism. We were a pillar of Western. West may
have
wished to retain.
It was around this time that the newspapers, which these same rich people owned, made sure the word Bolshe, a truncation of Bolshevik, entered the English language, so that we would associate Bolshevism with aggression. And it was with these subtle and not so subtle methods that the international elite began to shape our destiny for the remainder of the 20th century. The intellectuals of the period were furious. They were incensed. They were depressed. And you get a very good feeling of the political atmosphere of the time from the diaries of the Labour politician Harold Nicholson, when he writes, "We've lost our willpower since our willpower is divided. The people of the governing class think only of their own fortunes, which means hatred of the rest. Our class interests cut across our national interests, and I go to bed in gloom." With such heavy investment coming into the country, particularly from America and Britain, Germany began to recover very rapidly. And then the new class of international financiers began searching around for a homegrown, authoritarian political movement they could support. What they needed was someone they could count on to be both aggressive and expansionist. Ultra-right-wing causes, which at normal times would have been ignored and marginalized, were suddenly given very careful consideration, until finally the rich elite found a man and an idea which they felt might deliver the political outcome they desired. Adolf Hitler and his fledgling National Socialist Party. At the same time that the world's rich elite began grooming Hitler for his starring role, they also became even more deeply involved in military intelligence. I say even more because the Dulles brothers, Averell Harriman, and the chief of Remington, Samuel Bush, a man referred to as the original Merchant of Death, had a relationship with American military intelligence stretching back into World War I. The lesson here being that the American variant of military intelligence started out with businessmen protecting their investments, just as if they were a mafia. Right from the very beginning, it had nothing to do with national security and everything to do with money. In Hitler, the Illuminati had found a ready-made stooge who could be the face of this autocratic new movement. And when the time came to put together a new secret intelligence service which was going to help protect all the money they had tied up in the German economy, these men also found one was readily available, the Order of the Skull and Bones at Yale University. Discussion on secret societies is something of a minefield because it so easily invites ridicule. It is very difficult for the general public to accept that the super rich leaders of their Western world can possibly be as mad and deranged as they actually are. The public, generally speaking, are sensible and level-headed people who have to balance their checkbooks, so they inevitably tend to laugh at stories about Satanists and occult believers. But if you talk to any well-informed historians, they are all aware of the important role which various secret societies have played in human history. The Black Hand always played a pivotal role in the history of the Mafia. If you talk to anyone in the UK who was political and read books, they are always aware that the ruling class of Britain, including every member of the royal family, is a Freemason. And the emblem of the death's head was sported on the caps of the high-ranking Nazi officers from the very beginning. The symbols of these secret societies always seem to play around with some kind of skull and bones motif, so that it's abundantly clear what their mission statement is. These people are pirates, willing to commit any crime for big money. And they first became established in America at Yale University in 1833 with General William Huntington Russell and Alfonso Taft. Of course, being a secret society, they made other people curious about them. And in 1867, some undergraduates from a rival campus society broke into their headquarters to see what this skull and bones thing was all about. They reported that inside there were lots of lamps and candles, many dilapidated human skulls lying next to a fool's cap and bells. And it was morbidly dark because the walls were covered in black velvet. Having established a suitably satanic atmosphere, initiation rites were then performed on new members who had to engage in group masturbation and sodomy while they lay in a coffin. Now, it's very easy to dismiss all of this as bizarre, silly, and irrelevant until you see the list of Skull and Bones members who have ruled America since Skull and Bones began. Although they only graduate 15 initiates a year, those 15 have always gone on to occupy the very highest position in American society. U.S. Secretary of State William Max Evarts was a Bonesman, as was Treasury Secretary Franklin McVeigh, Chief Justice Simeon Eben Baldwin, and the 27th President of the United States, William Howard Taft. The founder of American football, Walter Camp, came through Skull and Bones, as did the very first chairman of the Federal Reserve, Pierre Jay, and director of Standard Oil, Percy Rockefeller. Averill Harriman, the son of E.H. Harriman, and founder of Harriman Brothers, the largest investment bank in the world, was a bondsman, and so were both of the George Bush presidents. During his premiership, John F. Kennedy was surrounded by bondsmen, like McGeorge Bundy and David Acheson, son of Dean Acheson. Kennedy knew these men referred to each other as brothers under the skin. They swear an oath of secrecy and then ruthlessly vow to help each other's careers in any way they can throughout their lives, even if it means committing murder. In Britain, every literate person knows that all of the top police officers are Freemasons, because if there are 10 candidates for a top job, a Mason will always select a brother Mason for the post. Skull and Bones works the same way, and JFK took this problem so seriously that he even made speeches warning America about the danger of secret societies.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically.
He knew the people on this list were neither silly nor irrelevant, because he knew they were the real holders of power in America, operating as they were, as an unelected shadow government, accountable to no one. And it was these same people who brought Hitler to power during the 1920s by becoming business partners with leading German industrialists. The reality of the situation prevailing at that time can be very easily understood simply by looking at the cover of Fritz Thyssen's book, I Paid Hitler, on which he is depicted as a puppet master controlling Hitler's strings. Thyssen was a billionaire industrialist. He was the man who built the Bismarck. His company, United Steelworks, made 3/4 of all Germany's steel, and he joined together with Skull and Bones members Prescott Bush and George Herbert Walker to financially assist the Nazi Party. Together, they recruited head of the German Central Bank, Jalmar Schacht, to the fascist cause, and then combined with other leading industrialists to sign the letter which convinced Hindenburg to appoint Hitler as Chancellor on the 20th of February, 1933. Had anyone inquired around this time about the postal address of the Nazi Party, they could legitimately have been told that it was 39 Broadway, Manhattan, New York, because this was where Averill Harriman, Prescott Bush, and George Herbert Walker kept their office. And being no fool, Fritz Thyssen used their banking services to set up secret cash funds funneled through another bank in Rotterdam, the Bank for Handel in Schaefer, to finance the building of the first official Nazi Party headquarters. the Brown House. This was all done with the full cooperation of the Dutch bankers, who orchestrated this entire sinister business with the assistance of the Thyssen family lawyer, Alan Dulles. Of course, the Germans themselves were ecstatic. We've all seen the newsreels from that time in which they are stomping around in their jackboots, acting like a master race, because they had swallowed the propaganda that they were being led to glory by a superman who had rebuilt the economy and Germany's infrastructure all by himself. This was a lie. Hitler didn't have any money. You can only build autobahns with one thing, capital investment, and that investment came mainly from America. The Nazis were also given a lot of help from the City of London, help which came mainly in the shape of Sir Montagu Collett Norman, Governor of the Bank of England. Norman was connected to Booth and Walker. Old British mill owners. Montagu Norman was heir to this colossal Brown Brothers fortune. As the de facto head of world banking, he made no secret of his only being interested in the richest 1% of people. And even as the newspapers began to fill the stories of Nazi concentration camps, he still declared himself to be Hitler's most avid supporter. "We must lend Nazi Germany 90 million marks," he declared. "It may never be repaid, but it will be less of a loss than the fall of Nazism." One might have thought Sir Montagu's close personal friends, the royal family, would have been outraged by his comments. Nothing could be further from the truth. It is part of the remit of this film to try and make people aware of the tricks the rich play in order to control how they think. George Orwell once said that the ruling class in every age have tried to impose a false view of the world upon their followers. And there's no better example than the way in which the British have been duped into believing that their royal family are called Windsor and descend from English kings like Henry VIII. The British royal family are actually German, and their real name is Saxe-Coburg-Gotha. They only changed it to Windsor after Windsor Castle in 1917 to hide the fact that they were German during the First World War. Prince Harry, in honor of his German roots, has been known to dress as a Nazi on several occasions. Dozens of critics have pointed out that the Duke of Edinburgh's brother was the head of the Nazi SS. And King Edward VIII, before he abdicated to marry the American divorcee, Wallace Simpson, visited Hitler to make it abundantly clear to the whole world that he too was a Nazi. He even signed his name Herzog von Windsor. Thinking people during this period realized that this whole thing with kissing up to the Führer somehow transcended national boundaries. The rich people from the most diverse countries had bonded together because they all shared a common goal. The kings and the queens and the international bankers and industrialists wanted to make certain communism could never succeed. They were determined that they weren't going to finish up the Russian royal family, and they were determined to hang on to their money. They were much more afraid of the ordinary working people in their own countries than they were of fascist Germany. And this prevailing sentiment amongst the world's ruling class led America's elite to attempt a fascist coup d'etat in 1934. I hope it will be plain to people by now that Hitler's economic miracle is the greatest myth in human history. There was no economic miracle. There are no miracles. And if there are, why can't the Germans do it all again now? If you want to construct a network of new roads, new steelworks, and new factories, you need one thing, money. You need investment. And the investment didn't come from Hitler. It came from Brown Brothers Harriman and their business associate, Fitz Thyssen. It came from Jean Marchand and his best friend, Sir Montagu Collett Norman. It came from men like Axel Wenner-Gren, the Swedish multimillionaire arms manufacturer, and Charles Bedeau, the French business mogul. These people were all in the same bed with their Nazi friends, the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, the Dulles brothers, Prescott Sheldon Bush, and George Herbert Walker, with whom they had created the Union Bank for laundering Nazi money. And with stage one of their plan for world domination complete, they now turn to the second phase which was meant to be the overthrow of American democracy and the imposition of fascist government upon the United States. In order to pull this off, these Nazis raised money from America's richest families, many of whom, in this new consumerist society, had become household names. The Colgate family, the Birdseye family, the DuPont family, the Rockefeller family, these people handed over millions to the American financiers of Hitler so they could hire, train, and supply a private army which would attempt to overthrow the democratically elected government of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and impose fascist dictatorship in America. Of course, it's natural to wonder, considering the added advantages, how on earth did they ever pull it off? The simple answer is that they chose the wrong man, because their choice to lead this Nazi insurrection was Major General Smedley Darlington Butler, the most decorated soldier of the period and in all of American history, perhaps the most unsung hero of all. Because Smedley Butler was the most genuine Democrat and lover of liberty the world has ever seen.
Appeared before the Congressional Committee, the highest representation of the American people under subpoena to tell what I knew of activity, which I believe might lead to an attempt to set up a fascist dictatorship. The plan as outlined to me was to form an organization of veterans.
All right, done it again here, done it again.
Supposed to lead an organization of 500,000 men, which would be able to take over the functions of government. My main interest in all this is to preserve our democratic institutions. I want to retain the right to vote, the right to speak freely, and the right to write. If we maintain these basic principles, our democracy is safe. No dictatorship can exist with suffrage, freedom of speech, and press.
Smedley Butler tricked the plotters into thinking he was interested for just long enough until he was sure who all the major players were, and then he told the president. This put FDR in a quite impossible position. America at that time was just coming out of the Great Depression. The last thing he wanted was to cause another economic downturn, and he feared that if he scooped up all the leading bankers and captains of industry in the United States and threw them all in jail, the country just might fall apart. So what could he do? To Smedley Butler's utter incredulity, he chose, in the end, to do nothing. In spite of the fact that these men had committed treason and should have been hanged, their power was such that they were not even charged, let alone tried. And so great was their influence, they were able to keep America out of the war until December the 7th, 1941. When the Japanese attacked on Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt finally realized he had to do something. His response was the Trading with the Enemy Act, which allowed him to seize assets like the Union Bank, through which Bush, Walker, and Harriman had been financing Thiessen. Roosevelt didn't realize, however, that it was already a case of too little, too late. Because without his knowledge, American business moguls had been tumbling over one another for 2 years in their efforts to assist and do business with the Hitler regime. Typical of this American spirit of enterprise was Sosthenes Bing, the president of AT&T. He flew immediately to Berlin when war was declared to put in Hitler's phone lines. He gave the Nazis the most high-tech, state-of-the-art telecommunication system in the world at the time, so that been hiring thugs to do their dirty work, especially to frighten people, since human civilization began. What people have to try to appreciate is that Nazism, in reality, was simply the first time in human history that the rich, and people have always assumed that the trucks used for the miles-long troop convoys must have been German trucks. But if anyone at that time had taken the trouble to lift up the cowling and look at the engine, they would have found these were actually Ford trucks, which had been built as sitting in his office 4,000 miles away in Dearborn, Michigan. A service for which he was given the Grand Cross of the Eagle, the highest honor the Nazis ever bestowed on a civilian. Ford sued the U.S. Army, the U.S. government in the 50s because during the war, the U.S. Air Force bombed their tank-making facilities in Germany. And this is true. And what was it, 52 or something, they sued the U.S. government for destroying their factories. And they won. They won the lawsuit. So I had to write a love poem for Henry here. It was so admired Henry Ford, he kept a life-size portrait of him on the wall next to his desk, and even his legendary Panzer tanks were tainted by these sorts of practices, because they were made by I.G. Farben, who had entered into a cartel with the Rockefellers, Standard Oil. The government in Washington knew all about this and largely did nothing. Licensing arrangements for trading with the enemy in wartime were issued without any fuss, even to the extent that after the occupation of France, the Chase and Morgan banks in Paris simply carried on doing business as usual. The incredible truth, which the rich elite have managed to hide from the world for 70 years through their control over school books and our education system, is that the Nazi war machine was actually an American business. And for the Rockefellers, DuPonts, Harrimans, Walkers, and Bushes in particular, it was a highly lucrative business. For their part, Coca-Cola's contribution to the war effort was to sell billions of soft drinks to the thirsty Nazis, while they were strafing and bombing Allied soldiers, particularly in very hot regions. In the deserts, where refrigerators tend to be scarce, there were even stories of Messerschmitt pilots wrapping wet towels around bottles of Coke, tying them picture of the railway leading into Auschwitz has, since World War II, become the iconic image of the Holocaust. To us, it now represents something like the gate to hell. But how differently, one wonders, would we have looked at this image all of our lives if we had always known that this railway line was an American railway line laid by the Harriman brothers on behalf of Uncle Sam. The Standard Oil IG Farben cartel even made the Zyklon B gas for the Jewish Holocaust. Now, anyone who at this point is thinking that all this simply cannot be true, because if it was, someone would have sued, well, someone did. This information came into the public domain because of a Dutch intelligence agent who was so disgusted when he found all of this out, he leaked it to the press, as a result of which, two very senior Jewish gentlemen, Kurt Julius Goldstein and Peter Gingold, filed suit against the American government. Of course, the more discriminating among us will now be asking how it can be that this story went completely unreported in the mainstream media. One might just as well ask why the Times in London was writing favorable stories about the Nazi concentration camps throughout the 1930s, and why Lord Rothermere was still referring to Hitler as a great gentleman as late as 1940. You really would think by now that people would have realized that it isn't so much the bias in the media that truly matters, it's the things they know about, but never tell you, that really matter. Because the truth is that the press knew exactly what was going on in the concentration camps all through the war. They never said a word about it, because they knew who was making money from the slave labor. Now, it's very easy to imagine what the response of a conservative politician, American or British, would be to all of this. If all of this is true, he's bound to ask why nobody said a word about American industrialists building Hitler's war machine at the Nuremberg trials. How come it never got mentioned?
Where's the responsibility of the Vatican, who signed in 1933 the Concordat with Hitler?
giving him his first tremendous prestige. Are we now to find the Vatican guilty? Where's the responsibility of the world leader Winston Churchill, who said in an open letter to the London Times in 1938? 1938! Your Honor! Were England to suffer national disaster, I should pray to God to send a man of the strength of mind and will of an Adolf Hitler. Are we now to find Winston Churchill guilty? Where's the responsibility of those American industrialists who helped Hitler to rebuild his armaments and profited from that rebuilding? Are we now to find the American industrialists guilty? No, Your Honor. No. Germany alone is not guilty. The whole world is as responsible for Hitler as Germany. It is an easy thing to condemn one man in the dark. It is easy to condemn the German people, to speak of the basic flaw in the German character that allowed Hitler to rise to power, but at the same time, comfortably, ignore the basic flaw of character that made the Russians sign pacts with him, Winston Churchill praise him, American desperates profit by him, American desperates profit by him, 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 profit by him.
In school, we are taught that the Allies defeated Nazi Germany in World War II. This is not true. The Nazis won the war because the real Nazis, the rich, played on both sides. That's what a rich businessman does. He arranges things so that he is well thought of by both sides, so then whoever wins, he wins, and his money is safe. Now, a lot of people will still think it is simply ludicrous to suggest the Second World War was a phony war. They are bound to say that no one who was there at the time thought it was a phony war. Really?
A new baby, 200 gross of buckles, unlimited petrol, and all the whiskey you want. You're sitting pretty, aren't you, Roland? Yes, it is a lovely war. Well, wouldn't you if you were in my place? Wouldn't everybody? Doesn't everybody? What a blasted phony, anyway. I'm a bit tired of it.
Tired of what?
This phony war business.
Well, isn't it?
No, it's not. I've just come out of hospital after 10 days in an open boat off the Faroes, and I'm sick and tired of boats like you with soft jobs ashore. Come outside!
Now, don't be silly.
I've lost 2 fingers off that hand, but I'm going to take you outside and knock your block off with my right.
Oh, take it easy. There's no need for that.
I'm sorry, I apologize. Pack them outside if you insist.
That won't do any good. It's not his fault. It's the fault of all of us.
You make me sick. All of you. It may be a phony war to you, but it's not to all the boys at sea. Never has been.
Now, obviously, the British, and the Dutch in particular, will have a very hard time accepting that their royal family profited from Nazi concentration camp slave labor. But if you go online, there is so much about this on the internet now. It's become plain that historians are more and more proving that those days were really all about the Western world's rich coming together to fund a Nazi war machine which was meant to protect them from the Soviets. The Duke of Edinburgh practically admitted this when he said, in those days we were anti-communists because the Russians killed half my bloody family. And when this cabal of secret Nazis got together to discuss how they were going to pay for this Nazi war machine, because rich people never accept a loss, they hired a psychopath, Hitler, who they knew would go along with their building concentration camps so that slave labor would pay for all the planes and the tanks and the guns. And you can see in the more intelligent movies from that period, like Hitchcock's Saboteur, that the artists and writers of that time knew the rich were fascist and completely understood what they were really up to.
Why is it that you sneer every time you refer to this country? You've done pretty well here. I don't get it.
No, you wouldn't. You're one of the ardent believers, a good American. All the millions like you, people that plod along without asking questions. I hate to use the word stupid, but it seems to be the only one that applies. the great masses, the moron millions. Well, there are a few of us who are unwilling to just troop along. A few of us who are clever enough to see that there's much more to be done than just live small, complacent lives. A few of us in America who desire a more profitable type of government. When you think about it, Mr. Kane, the competence of totalitarian nations is much higher than ours. They get things done.
Yeah. They get things done. They bomb cities, sink ships, torture and murder so you and your friends can eat off of gold plate. It's a great philosophy.
I neither intend to be bombed nor sunk, Mr. Kane. That's why I'm leaving now. And if things don't go right for you, if we should win, then I'll come back. Perhaps I can get what I want then. Power. Yes. I want that as much as you want your comfort or your job or that girl. We all have different tastes, as you can see. Only I'm willing to back my tastes with the necessary force.
Where was the Mafia while all this was going on?
Well, a great deal, which historians have learned recently, especially from sources like Double Cross, the book written by Sam Giancana's brother, has made it clear that the Mafia was much the same as the so-called German economic miracle and the American finance Nazi war machine and concentration camps. The mob, in reality, was a very different animal from the one portrayed by the movies and the media. American feature films have tended to focus on the exploits of gangsters like Richard Kane, the famous crime-busting Chicago cop who was planted in the police force to be a spy for Giancana, and hoods like Charles Nicoletti and Milwaukee Phil Aldericio, two of his favorite hitmen who built their own hitmobile so they could shoot people from the back of a moving car. Amongst many other atrocities this pair committed was one in which they forced the head of Billy McCarthy into a vice and squeezed until his eyeball popped out, an incident which a certain American film director felt was so entertaining, he included it in one of his movies. What most people have failed to realize, however, is that in most cases, the Mafia chieftains who actually ran organized crime did not approve, generally speaking, of these acts of gross brutality. Not that they gave a damn about morals, but the cleverest amongst them, like Paul the Waiter Rica, realized that sensationalized events like the St. Valentine's Day Massacre produced public outrage and a crackdown on their illegal activities. Rica realized that the effectiveness of mobsters like Diamond Joe Esposito came from keeping a low profile. And it was the Mafia bosses who learned this lesson best, Santos Traficante and Sam Giancana in particular, who in later years became the most successful. Even today, few Americans appreciate the extent to which their country was being controlled by organized crime in the 1930s. The mob were in total control of Hollywood because all the union labor needed to make films, carpenters, set construction, catering, they were all under the control of the mob. In particular, the control of the Teamsters Union, the drivers and haulage people who made essential deliveries to absolutely everyone, meant that virtually all American business was caught in the web of Mafia racketeering. Studio bosses like Harry Cohn, Louis B. Mayer, and the Warner Brothers knew they had to play along to get anything done at all. The big studio heads, like all rich businessmen, found they were forced to become friends with Mafia dons. And the individual who exploited this situation most effectively was a gangster few people have ever heard of, Murray the Camel Humphreys. Generally speaking, the ethnically Italian gangsters of this period were coarse, brutal, and most importantly, ignorant men. They had no education. They couldn't hold an intelligent conversation because they'd spent no time in school.
Don Corleone, I am honored and grateful that you have invited me to your daughter's wedding. On the day of your daughter's wedding.
This made doing business with refined and sophisticated entrepreneurs difficult, not to say embarrassing. And Sam Giancana was quick to spot this. So whenever a business deal needed to be made by someone with style and sophistication, he would send along his silver-tongued Welshman, Murray the Camel, so-called because he was known for being sartorial and for cutting a dash in expensive camel hair coats. Humphreys became a crucial figure during the pre-war period because his contact with the luminaries of Hollywood meant he received invitations from senior politicians who wanted to rub shoulders with stars like Clark Gable, George Raft, Cary Grant, Gary Cooper, Marilyn Monroe, and Frank Sinatra, all of whom were mafia-controlled and used by the mob as bagmen, moving colossal sums of money around the country. Because Giancana cynically realized the authorities were too starstruck to ever check their luggage.
All right. That's it. Sorry for the problems today. Out of my hands. Thank you for listening. See you tomorrow.